At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Chapter 6 of The Agony Column. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Peak. The Agony Column by Earl Durr Biggers. Chapter 6. The last piece Sunday London was to know in many weary months went by, a tense and anxious day. Early on Monday, the fifth letter from the young man of the Agony Column arrived, and when the girl from Texas read it, she knew that under no circumstances could she leave London now. It ran, "Dear Lady from Home, I call you that because the word home has for me, this hot afternoon in London, about the sweetest sound word ever had. I can see, when I close my eyes, Broadway at midday, Fifth Avenue gay and colorful, even with all the best people away. Washington Square, cool under the trees, lovely and desirable despite the presence everywhere of alien neighbors from the district to the south. I long for home with an ardent longing. Never was London so cruel, so hopeless, so drab in my eyes. For, as I write this, a constable sits at my elbow, and he and I are shortly to start for Scotland Yard. I have been arrested as a suspect in the case of Captain Fraser Freer's murder. I predicted last night that this was to be a red letter day in the history of that case, and I also saw myself an unwilling actor in the drama, but little did I suspect the series of astonishing events that was to come with the morning. Little did I dream that the net I have been dreading would today engulf me. I can scarcely blame Inspector Bray for holding me. What I cannot understand is why Colonel Hughes... But you want, of course, the whole story from the beginning, and I shall give it to you. At 11 o'clock this morning, a constable called on me at my rooms and informed me that I was wanted at once by the chief inspector at the yard. We climbed, the constable and I, a narrow stone stairway somewhere at the back of New Scotland Yard, and so came to the inspector's room. Bray was waiting for us, smiling and confident. I remember, silly as the detail is, that he wore in his buttonhole a white rose. His manner of greeting me was more genial than usual. He began by informing me that the police had apprehended the man who, they believed, was guilty of the captain's murder. "There is one detail to be cleared up," he said. "You told me the other night that it was shortly after 7 o'clock when you heard the sounds of struggle in the room above you. You were somewhat excited at the time, and under similar circumstances men have been known to make mistakes. Have you considered the matter since? Is it not possible that you were in error in regard to the hour?" I recalled Hugh's advice to humor the inspector, and I said that, having thought it over, I was not quite sure. It might have been earlier than 7, say 6:30. "Exactly," said Bray. He seemed rather pleased. "The natural stress of the moment, I understand. Wilkinson, bring in your prisoner." Constable Address turned and left the room, coming back a moment later with Lieutenant Norman Fraser Freer. The boy was pale. I could see at a glance that he had not slept for several nights. "Lieutenant," said Bray, very sharply, "will you tell me, is it true that your brother, the late captain, had loaned you a large sum of money a year or so ago?"
"Quite true," answered the lieutenant in a low voice.
"You and he had quarreled about the amount of money you spent?"
"Yes."
"By his death you became the sole heir of your father, the general. Your position with the moneylenders was quite altered. Am I right?"
"I fancy so."
"Last Thursday afternoon you went to the Army and Navy stores and purchased a revolver. You already had your service weapon, but to shoot a man with a bullet from that would be to make the hunt of the police for the murder absurdly simple." The boy made no answer. "Let us suppose," Bray went on, "that last Thursday evening at 6:30 you called on your brother in his rooms at Adelphi Terrace. There was an argument about money. You became enraged. You saw him, and him alone, between you and the fortune you needed so badly.
Then, I am only supposing, you noticed on his table an odd knife he had brought from India, safer, more silent than a gun. You seized it. Why suppose, the boy broke in, I'm not trying to conceal anything. You're right. I did it. I killed my brother. Now let us get the whole business over with as soon as may be.
Into the face of Inspector Bray there came at that moment a look that has puzzled me ever since, a look that has recurred to my mind again and again in the stress and storm of this eventful day. It was only too evident that this confession came to him as a shock. I presume so easy a victory seemed hollow to him. He was wishing the boy had put up a fight. Policemen are probably like that.
"My boy," he said, "I am sorry for you. My course is clear. If you will go with one of my men..."
It was at this point that the door of the inspector's room opened, and Colonel Hughes, cool and smiling, walked in. Bray chuckled at the sight of the military man.
"Ah, Colonel," he cried, "you make a good entrance. This morning, when I discovered that I had the honor of having you associated with me in the search for the captain's murderer, you were foolish enough to make a little wager."
"I remember," Hughes answered, "a scarab pin against a Homburg hat."
"Precisely," said Bray.
"You wagered that you, and not I, would discover the guilty man.
Well, Colonel, you owe me a scarab.
Lieutenant Norman Fraser Freer has just told me that he killed his brother, and I was on the point of taking down his full confession."
"Indeed," replied Hughes calmly. "Interesting, most interesting. But before we consider the wager lost, before you force the lieutenant to confess in full, I should like the floor."
"Certainly," smiled Bray.
"When you were kind enough to let me have two of your men this morning," said Hughes, "I told you I contemplated the arrest of a lady. I have brought that lady to Scotland Yard with me."
He stepped to the door, opened it, and beckoned. A tall, blonde, handsome woman of about 35 entered, and instantly to my nostrils came the pronounced odor of lilacs.
"Allow me, Inspector," went on the Colonel, "to introduce to you the Countess Sophie de Graff, late of Berlin, late of Delhi and Rangoon, now of 17 Leitrim Grove, Battersea Park Road."
The woman faced Bray, and there was a terrified, hunted look in her eyes.
"You are the inspector?" she asked.
"I am," said Bray.
"And a man, I can see that,"
she went on, her eyes flashing angrily at Hughes.
"I appeal to you to protect me from the brutal questioning of this fiend."
"You are hardly complimentary, Countess," Hughes smiled, "but I am willing to forgive you if you will tell the inspector the story that you have recently related to me."
The woman shut her lips tightly and for a long moment gazed into the eyes of Inspector Bray.
"He," she said at last, nodding in the direction of Colonel Hughes, "he got it out of me. How, I don't know."
"Got what out of you?" Bray's little eyes were blinking.
"At 6:30 last Thursday evening," said the woman, "I went to the rooms of Captain Fraser Freer in Adelphi Terrace. An argument arose. I seized from his table an Indian dagger that was lying there. I stabbed him, just above the heart."
In that room in Scotland Yard a tense silence fell. For the first time we were all conscious of a tiny clock on the inspector's desk, for it ticked now with a loudness sudden and startling. I gazed at the faces about me, Bray's showing a momentary surprise, then the mask fell again. Lieutenant Fraser Freer was plainly amazed. On the face of Colonel Hughes I saw what struck me as an open sneer.
"Go on, Countess," he smiled.
She shrugged her shoulders and turned toward him a disdainful back. Her eyes were all for Bray.
"It's very brief, the story," she said hastily, and I thought almost apologetically. "I had known the captain in Rangoon. My husband was in business there, an exporter of rice, and Captain Fraser Freer came often to our house. He was a charming man, the captain."
"Go on," ordered Hughes.
"We fell desperately in love," said the Countess. "When he returned to England, though supposedly on furlough, he told me he would never return to Rangoon.
He expected a transfer to Egypt. So it was arranged that I should desert my husband and follow on the next boat. I did so, believing in the captain, thinking he really cared for me. I gave up everything for him, and then..." Her voice broke, and she took out a handkerchief. Again that odor of lilacs in the room. "For a time I saw the captain often in London, and then I began to notice a change. Back among his own kind, with the lonely days in India a mere memory, he seemed no longer to care for me. Then, last Thursday morning, he called on me to tell me that he was through, that he would never see me again, in fact, that he was to marry a girl of his own people who had been waiting." The woman looked piteously about at us. "I was desperate," she pleaded. "I had given up all that life held for me, given it up for a man who now looked at me coldly and spoke of marrying another. Can you wonder that I went in the evening to his rooms, went to plead with him, to beg, almost on my knees? It was no use. He was done with me. He said that over and over. Overwhelmed with blind rage and despair, I snatched up that knife from the table and plunged it into his heart. At once I was filled with remorse. I..."
"One moment," broke in Hughes. "You may keep the details of your subsequent actions until later. I should like to compliment you, Countess. You tell it better each time."
He came over and faced Bray. I thought there was a distinct note of hostility in his voice.
"Checkmate, Inspector," he said.
Bray made no reply. He sat there staring up at the colonel, his face turned to stone.
"The scarab pin," went on Hughes, "is not yet forthcoming. We are tied for honors, my friend. You have your confession, but I have one to match it."
"All this is beyond me," snapped Bray. "A bit beyond me, too," the colonel answered. "Here are two people who wish us to believe that on the evening of Thursday last, at 6:30 of the clock, each sought out Colonel Fraser Freer in his rooms and murdered him."
He walked to the window and then wheeled dramatically. "The strangest part of it all is," he added, "that at 6:30 o'clock last Thursday evening, at an obscure restaurant in Soho, Frigashi's, these two people were having tea together."
I must admit that as the colonel calmly offered this information, I suddenly went limp all over at a realization of the endless maze of mystery in which we are involved. The woman gave a little cry, and Lieutenant Fraser Freer leapt to his feet.
"How the devil do you know that?" he cried.
"I know it," said Colonel Hughes, "because one of my men happened to be having tea at a table nearby. He happened to be having tea there for the reason that ever since the arrival of this lady back in London, at the request of friends in India, I have been keeping track of her every move, just as I kept watch over your late brother, the captain." Without a word, Lieutenant Fraser Freer dropped into a chair and buried his face in his hands.
"I'm sorry, my son," said Hughes. "Really, I am. You made a heroic effort to keep the facts from coming out. A man-size effort it was. But the War Office knew long before you did that your brother had succumbed to this woman's lure, that he was serving her and Berlin, and not his own country, England."
Fraser Freer raised his head. When he spoke, there was in his voice an emotion vastly more sincere than that which had moved him when he made his absurd confession.
"The game's up," he said. "I have done all I could. This will kill my father, I am afraid. Ours has been an honorable name, Colonel. You know that. A long line of military men whose loyalty to their country has never before been in question. I thought my confession would end the whole nasty business, that the investigations would stop, and that I might be able to keep forever unknown this horrible thing about him, about my brother."
Colonel Hughes laid his hand on the boy's shoulder, and the latter went on. "They reached me, those frightful insinuations about Stephen, in a roundabout way, and when he came home from India, I resolved to watch him. I saw him go often to the house of this woman.
I satisfied myself that she was the same one involved in the stories coming from Rangoon. Then, under another name, I managed to meet her. I hinted to her that I myself was none too loyal, not completely, but to a limited extent I won her confidence. Gradually I became convinced that my brother was indeed disloyal to his country, to his name, to us all. It was at that tea time you have mentioned that I finally made up my mind. I had already bought a revolver, and with it in my pocket I went to the Savoy for dinner. He rose and paced the floor. I left the Savoy early and went to Stephen's rooms. I was resolved to have it out with him, to put the matter to him bluntly, and if he had no explanation to give me, I intended to kill him then and there. So, you see, I was guilty in intention, if not in reality. I entered his study. It was filled with strangers. On his sofa I saw my brother Stephen lying, stabbed above the heart, dead. There was a moment's silence. "That is all," said Lieutenant Fraser Freer.
"I take it," said Hughes kindly, "that we have finished with the lieutenant, eh, Inspector?" "Yes," said Bray shortly. "You may go."
"Thank you," the boy answered. As he went out, he said brokenly to Hughes, "I must find him, my father."
Bray sat in his chair, staring hard ahead, his jaw thrust out angrily. Suddenly he turned on Hughes.
"You don't play fair," he said. "I wasn't told anything of the status of the captain at the War Office. This is all news to me."
"Very well," smiled Hughes. "The bet is off, if you like."
"No, by heaven," Bray cried. "It's still on, and I'll win it yet. A fine morning's work, I suppose you think you've done. But are we any nearer to finding the murderer? Tell me that."
"Only a bit nearer, at any rate," Hughes replied suavely. "This lady, of course, remains in custody."
"Yes, yes," answered the inspector. "Take her away," he ordered.
A constable came forward for the countess, and Colonel Hughes gallantly held open the door. "You will have an opportunity, Sophie," he said, "to think up another story. You are clever. It will not be hard." She gave him a black look and went out. Bray got up from his desk. He and Colonel Hughes stood facing each other across a table, and to me there was something in the manner of each that suggested eternal conflict.
"Well," sneered Bray.
"There is one possibility we have overlooked," Hughes answered. He turned toward me, and I was startled by the coldness in his eyes. "Do you know, Inspector," he went on, "that this American came to London with a letter of introduction to the captain?"
"A letter from the captain's cousin, one Archibald Enright."
"And do you know that Fraser Freer had no cousin of that name?"
"No," said Bray.
"It happens to be the truth," said Hughes. "The American has confessed as much to me."
"Then," said Bray to me, and his little blinking eyes were on me with a narrow, calculating glance that sent shivers up and down my spine, "you are under arrest. I have exempted you so far because of your friend at the United States Consulate. That exemption ends now."
I was thunderstruck. I turned to the colonel, the man who had suggested that I seek him out if I needed a friend, the man I had looked to save me from just such a contingency as this, but his eyes were quite fishy and unsympathetic.
"Quite correct, Inspector," he said. "Lock him up." And as I began to protest, he passed very close to me and spoke in a low voice,
"Say nothing. Wait."
I pleaded to be allowed to go back to my rooms, to communicate with my friends, and pay a visit to our consulate and to the embassy, and at the colonel's suggestion Bray agreed to this somewhat irregular course. So this afternoon I have been abroad with a constable, and while I wrote this long letter to you he has been fidgeting in my easy chair. Now he informs me that his patience is exhausted, and that I must go at once. So there is no time to wonder, no time to speculate as to the future, as to the colonel's sudden turn against me, or the promise of his whisper in my ear. I shall, no doubt, spend the night behind those hideous, forbidding walls that your guide has pointed out to you as New Scotland Yard, and when I shall write again, when I shall end this series of letters so filled with—the constable will not wait.
He is as impatient as a child. Surely he is lying when he says I have kept him here an hour. Wherever I am, dear lady, whatever be the end of this amazing tangle, you may be sure the thought of you, confound the man. Yours in durance vile. This fifth letter from the young man of the agony column arrived at the Carlton Hotel, as the reader may recall, on Monday morning, August the 3rd. And it represented to the girl from Texas the climax of the excitement she had experienced in the matter of the murder in Adelphi Terrace. The news that her pleasant young friend, whom she did not know, had been arrested as a suspect in the case, inevitable as it had seemed for days, came nonetheless as an unhappy shock. She wondered whether there was anything she could do to help. She even considered going to Scotland Yard, and on the ground that her father was a congressman from Texas demanding the immediate release of her strawberry man. Sensibly, however, she decided that congressman from Texas meant little in the life of the London police. Besides, she might have difficulty in explaining to that same congressman how she happened to know all about a crime that was as yet unmentioned in the newspapers. So she reread the latter portion of the fifth letter, which pictured her hero marched off ingloriously to Scotland Yard, and with a worried little sigh, went below to join her father. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7 of the Agony Column. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Peak. The Agony Column by Earl Durr Biggers. Chapter 7. In the course of the morning, she made several mysterious inquiries of her parent regarding nice points of international law as it concerned murder, and it is probable that he would have been struck by the odd nature of these questions had he not been unduly excited about another matter.
"I tell you, we've got to get home," he announced gloomily. "The German troops are ready at Aix-la-Chapelle for an assault on Liège. Yes, sir, they're going to strike through Belgium. Know what that means? England in the war. Labor troubles, suffragette troubles, civil war in Ireland. These things will melt away as quickly as that snow we had last winter in Texas. They'll go in. It would be national suicide if they didn't."
His daughter stared at him. She was unaware that it was the bootblack at the Carlton he was now quoting. She began to think that he knew more about foreign affairs than she had given him credit for.
"Yes, sir," he went on, "we've got to travel. Fast. This won't be a healthy neighborhood for non-combatants when the ruction starts. I'm going if I have to buy a liner."
"Nonsense," said the girl. "This is the chance of a lifetime. I won't be cheated out of it by a silly old dad. Why, here we are, face to face with history."
"American history is good enough for me," he spread-eagled. "What are you looking at?"
"Provincial to the death," she said thoughtfully. "You old dear, I love you so. Some of our statesmen over home are going to look pretty foolish now in the face of things they can't understand. I hope you're not going to be one of them."
"Twaddle," he cried. "I'm going to the steamship offices today and argue as I have never argued for a vote."
His daughter saw that he was determined, and, wise from long experience, she did not try to dissuade him. London, that hot Monday, was a city on the alert, a city of hearts heavy with dread. The rumors in one special edition of the papers were denied in the next, and reaffirmed in the next. Men who could look into the future walked the streets with faces far from happy. Unrest ruled the town, and it found its echo in the heart of the girl from Texas as she thought of her young friend of the agony column, in durance vile, behind the frowning walls of Scotland Yard. That afternoon her father appeared, with the beaming mien of the victor, and announced that for a stupendous sum he had bought the tickets of a man who was to have sailed on the steamship Saronia 3 days hence. "The boat train leaves at 10 Thursday morning," he said. "Take your last look at Europe and be ready."
3 days! His daughter listened with sinking heart. Could she, in 3 days' time, learn the end of that strange mystery, know the final fate of the man who had first addressed her so unconventionally in a public print? Why, at the end of 3 days, he might still be in Scotland Yard, a prisoner. She could not leave if that were true. She simply could not. Almost she was on the point of telling her father the story of the whole affair, confident that she could soothe his anger and enlist his aid. She decided to wait until the next morning, and if no letter came then... But on Tuesday morning, a letter did come, and the beginning of it brought pleasant news. The beginning, yes, but the end. This was the letter. Dear anxious lady, is it too much for me to assume that you have been just that, knowing as you did that I was locked up for the murder of a captain in the Indian Army, with the evidence all against me, and hope a very still small voice indeed? Well, dear lady, be anxious no longer. I have just lived through the most astounding day and all the astounding days that have been my portion since last Thursday, and now, in the dusk, I sit again in my rooms, a free man, and write to you in what peace and quiet I can command after the startling adventure through which I have recently passed. Suspicion no longer points to me, constables no longer eye me, Scotland Yard is not even slightly interested in me, for the murderer of Captain Fraser Freer has been caught at last. Sunday night I spent ingloriously in a cell in Scotland Yard. I could not sleep. I had so much to think of, you, for example, and at intervals how I might escape from the folds of the net that had closed so tightly about me. My friend at the consulate, Watson, called on me late in the evening, and he was very kind, but there was a note lacking in his voice, and after he had gone the terrible certainty came into my mind. He believed that I was guilty after all. The night passed, and a goodly portion of today went by, as the poets say, with lagging feet. I thought of London, yellow in the sun. I thought of the Carlton. I suppose there are no more strawberries by this time. And my waiter, that stiff-backed Prussian, is home in Deutschland now, I presume, marching with his regiment. I thought of you. At 3 o'clock this afternoon they came for me, and I was led back to the room belonging to Inspector Bray. When I entered, however, the inspector was not there, only Colonel Hughes, immaculate and self-possessed as usual, gazing out the window into the cheerless stone court. He turned when I entered. I suppose I must have had a most woebegone appearance, for a look of regret crossed his face. "My dear fellow," he cried, "my most humble apologies. I intended to have you released last night, but believe me, I have been frightfully busy." I said nothing. What could I say? The fact that he had been busy struck me as an extremely silly excuse. But the inference that my escape from the toils of the law was imminent set my heart to thumping. "I fear that you can never forgive me for throwing you over as I did yesterday," he went on. "I can only say that it was absolutely necessary, as you shall shortly understand." I thought a bit. After all, there was an unmistakable sincerity in his voice and manner. "We are waiting for Inspector Bray," continued the colonel. "I take it you wish to see this thing through?" "To the end," I answered. "Naturally. The inspector was called away yesterday immediately after our interview with him. He had business on the continent, I understand. But fortunately I managed to reach him at Dover, and he has come back to London. I wanted him, you see, because I have found the murderer of Captain Fraser Freer." I thrilled to hear that, for from my point of view it was certainly a consummation devoutly to be wished. The colonel did not speak again. In a few moments the door opened and Bray came in. His clothes looked as though he had slept in them. His little eyes were bloodshot, but in those eyes there was a fire I shall never forget. Hughes bowed. "Good afternoon, Inspector," he said. "I'm really sorry I had to interrupt you as I did. But I most awfully wanted you to know that you owe me a Homburg hat." He went closer to the detective. "You see, I have won that wager. I have found the man who murdered Captain Fraser Freer." Curiously enough, Bray said nothing. He sat down at his desk and idly glanced through the pile of mail that lay upon it. Finally, he looked up and said in a weary tone, "You're very clever, I'm sure, Colonel Hughes." "Oh, I wouldn't say that," replied Hughes. "Luck was with me from the first. I am really very glad to have been of service in the matter, for I am convinced that if I had not taken part in the search, it would have gone hard with some innocent man." Bray's big, pudgy hands still played idly with the mail on his desk. Hughes went on, "Perhaps, as a clever detective, you will be interested in the series of events which enabled me to win that Homburg hat. You have heard, no doubt, that the man I have caught is Von der Hertz, 10 years ago the best Secret Service man in the employ of the Berlin government, but for the past few years mysteriously missing from our line of vision. We've been wondering about him at the War Office. The colonel dropped into a chair, facing Bray. "You know Von der Hertz, of course," he remarked casually. "Of course," said Bray, still in that dead, tired voice. "He is the head of that crowd in England," went on Hughes. "Rather a feather in my cap to get him. But I mustn't boast. Poor Fraser Fear would have got him if I hadn't. Only Von der Hertz had the luck to get the captain first." Bray raised his eyes. "You said you were going to tell me," he began. "And so I am," said Hughes. "Captain Fraser Freer got in rather a mess in India and failed of promotion. It was suspected that he was discontented, soured on the service, and the Countess Sophie de Graff was set to beguile him with her charms, to kill his loyalty and win him over to her crowd. It was thought she had succeeded. The Wilhelmstrasse thought so. We at the War Office thought so, as long as he stayed in India. But when the captain and the woman came to London, we discovered that we had done him a great injustice. He let us know, when the first chance offered, that he was trying to redeem himself, to round up a dangerous band of spies by pretending to be one of them. He said that it was his mission in London to meet Von der Hertz, the greatest of them all, and that once he had located this man, we would hear from him again. In the weeks that followed, I continued to keep a watch on the Countess, and I kept track of the captain, too, in a general way, for I'm ashamed to say I was not quite sure of him." The colonel got up and walked to the window, then turned and continued, "Captain Fraser Freer and Von der Hertz were completely unknown to each other. The mails were barred as a means of communication, but Fraser Freer knew that in some way word from the master would reach him, and he had had a tip to watch the personal column in the Daily Mail. Now we have the explanation for those 4 odd messages. From that column, the man from Rangoon learned that he was to wear a white aster in his buttonhole, a scarab pin in his tie, a Homburg hat on his head, and meet Von der Hertz at ye old Grabrinus restaurant in Regent Street last Thursday night at 10 o'clock. As we know, he made all arrangements to comply with those directions. He made other arrangements as well. Since it was out of the question for him to come to Scotland Yard, by skillful maneuvering he managed to interview an inspector of police at the Hotel Cecil. It was agreed that on Thursday night Von der Hertz would be placed under arrest the moment he made himself known to the captain." Hughes paused. Bray still idled with his pile of letters, while the colonel regarded him gravely. "Poor Fraser Freer," Hughes went on. "Unfortunately for him, Von der Hertz knew almost as soon as did the inspector that a plan was afoot to trap him. There was but one course open to him. He located the captain's lodgings, went there at 7 that night, and killed a loyal and brave Englishman where he stood." A tense silence filled the room. I sat on the edge of my chair, wondering just where all this unwinding of the tangle was leading us. "I had little, indeed, to work on," went on Hughes. "But I had this advantage. The spy thought the police, and the police alone, were seeking the murderer. He was at no pains to throw me off his track, because he did not suspect that I was on it. For weeks my men had been watching the Countess. I had them continue to do so. I figured that sooner or later Von der Hertz would get in touch with her. I was right, and when at last I saw with my own eyes the man who must, beyond all question, be Von der Hertz, I was astounded. My dear inspector, I was overwhelmed."
"Yes," said Bray.
"I set to work then in earnest to connect him with that night in Adelphi Terrace. All the finger marks in the captain's study were for some reason destroyed, but I found others outside, in the dust on that seldom used gate which leads from the garden. Without his knowing, I secured from the man I suspected the imprint of his right thumb. A comparison was startling. Next I went down into Fleet Street, and luckily managed to get hold of the typewritten copy sent to the mail, burying those 4 messages. I noticed that in these the letter A was out of alignment. I maneuvered to get a letter written on a typewriter belonging to my man. The A was out of alignment. Then Archibald Enright, a renegade and a waster well known to us as serving other countries, came to England. My man and he met at Ye Olde Gambrinus in Regent Street. And finally, on a visit to the lodgings of this man, who, I was now certain, was Von der Hertz, under the mattress of his bed I found this knife. And Colonel Hughes threw down upon the inspector's desk the knife from India that I had last seen in the study of Captain Fraser Freer. "All these points of evidence were in my hands yesterday morning in this room," Hughes went on. "Still, the answer they gave me was so unbelievable, so astounding, I was not satisfied. I wanted even stronger proof. That is why I directed suspicion to my American friend here. I was waiting. I knew that at last Von der Hertz realized the danger he was in. I felt that if an opportunity were offered, he would attempt to escape from England, and then our proofs of his guilt would be unanswerable, despite his cleverness. True enough, in the afternoon he secured the release of the Countess, and together they started for the Continent. I was lucky enough to get him at Dover, and glad to let the lady go on. And now for the first time the startling truth struck me full in the face as Hughes smiled down at his victim. "Inspector Bray," he said, "or Von der Hertz, as you choose, I arrest you on two counts. First, as the head of the Wilhelmstrasse spy system in England. Second, as the murderer of Captain Fraser Freer. And, if you will allow me, I wish to compliment you on your efficiency." Bray did not reply for a moment. I sat numb in my chair. Finally, the inspector looked up. He actually tried to smile. "You win the hat," he said. "But you must go to Hamburg for it. I will gladly pay all expenses." "Thank you," answered Hughes. "I hope to visit your country before long, but I shall not be occupied with hats. Again, I congratulate you. You were a bit careless, but your position justified that. As head of the department at Scotland Yard given over to the hunt for spies, precaution doubtless struck you as unnecessary. How unlucky for poor Fraser Freer that it was to you he went to arrange for your own arrest. I got that information from a clerk at the Cecil. You were quite right, from your point of view, to kill him. And, as I say, you could afford to be rather reckless. You had arranged that, when the news of his murder came to Scotland Yard, you yourself would be on hand to conduct the search for the guilty man. A happy situation, was it not?"
"It seemed so at the time," admitted Bray, and at last I thought I detected a note of bitterness in his voice.
"I'm very sorry, really," said Hughes. "Today, or tomorrow at the latest, England will enter the war. You know what that means, Von der Hertz. The Tower of London and a firing squad." Deliberately he walked away from the inspector and stood facing the window. Von der Hertz was fingering idly that Indian knife which lay on his desk. With a quick, hunted look about the room, he raised his hand, and before I could leap forward to stop him, he had plunged the knife into his heart. Colonel Hughes turned round at my cry, but even at what met his eyes now, the Englishman was imperturbable. "Too bad," he said. "Really, too bad. The man had courage, and beyond all doubt, brains. But this is most considerate of him. He has saved me such a lot of trouble." The colonel effected my release at once, and he and I walked down Whitehall together in the bright sun that seemed so good to me after the bleak walls of the yard. Again he apologized for turning suspicion my way the previous day, but I assured him I held no grudge for that. "One or two things I do not understand," I said. "That letter I brought from Interlaken." "Simple enough," he replied. "Enright, who, by the way, is now in the Tower, wanted to communicate with Fraser Freer, who he supposed was a loyal member of the band. Letters sent by post seemed dangerous. With your kind assistance, he informed the captain of his whereabouts and the date of his imminent arrival in London. Fraser Freer, not wanting you entangled in his plans, eliminated you by denying the existence of this cousin. The truth, of course." "Why," I asked, "did the Countess call on me to demand that I alter my testimony?" "Bray sent her. He had rifled Fraser Freer's desk, and he held that letter from Enright. He was most anxious to fix the guilt upon the young lieutenant's head. You and your testimony as to the hour of the crime stood in the way. He sought to intimidate you with threats.
But
I know you are wondering why the Countess confessed to me next day. I had the woman in rather a funk. In the meshes of my rapid-fire questioning, she became hopelessly involved. This was because she was suddenly terrified. She realized I must have been watching her for weeks, and that perhaps von der Herts was not so immune from suspicion as he supposed. At the proper moment, I suggested that I might have to take her to Inspector Bray. This gave her an idea. She made her fake confession to reach his side. Once there, she warned him of his danger, and they fled together. We walked along a moment in silence. All about us the lurid special editions of the afternoon were flaunting their predictions of the horror to come. The face of the colonel was grave. "How long had von der Herts held his position at the Yard?" I asked. "For nearly 5 years," Hughes answered. "It seems incredible," I murmured. "So it does," he answered. "But it is only the first of many incredible things that this war will reveal. 2 months from now, we shall all have forgotten it in the face of new revelations far more unbelievable." He sighed. "If these men about us realized the terrible ordeal that lies ahead, misgoverned, unprepared, I shudder at the thought of the sacrifices we must make, many of them in vain. But I suppose that somehow, some day, we shall muddle through." He bade me good-bye in Trafalgar Square, saying he must at once seek out the father and brother of the late captain, and tell them the news, that their kinsman was really loyal to his country. "It will come to them as a ray of light in the dark, my news," he said. "And now, thank you, once again." We parted, and I came back here to my lodgings. The mystery is finally solved, though in such a way it is difficult to believe that it was anything but a nightmare at any time. But solved nonetheless, and I should be at peace, except for one great black fact that haunts me, will not let me rest. I must tell you, dear lady, and yet I fear it means the end of everything. If only I can make you understand. I have walked my floor deep in thought, in puzzlement, in indecision. Now I have made up my mind. There is no other way. I must tell you the truth. Despite the fact that Bray was von der Herts, despite the fact that he killed himself at the discovery, despite this and that and everything, Bray did not kill Captain Fraser Freer. On last Thursday evening, at a little after 7 o'clock, I myself climbed the stairs, entered the captain's rooms, picked up that knife from his desk, and stabbed him just above the heart. What provocation I was under, what stern necessity moved me, all this you must wait until tomorrow to know. I shall spend another anxious day preparing my defense, hoping that through some miracle of mercy you may forgive me, understand that there was nothing else I could do. Do not judge, dear lady, until you know everything, until all my evidence is in your lovely hands. Yours in all humility. The first few paragraphs of this, the sixth and next to the last letter from the agony column man, had brought a smile of relief to the face of the girl who read. She was decidedly glad to learn that her friend no longer languished back of those gray walls on Victoria Embankment. With excitement that increased as she went along, she followed Colonel Hughes as, in the letter, he moved nearer and nearer his denouement, until finally his finger pointed to Inspector Bray, sitting guilty in his chair. This was an eminently satisfactory solution, and it served the inspector right for locking up her friend. Then, with the suddenness of a bomb from a Zeppelin, came, at the end, her strawberry man's confession of guilt. He was the murderer after all. He admitted it. She could scarcely believe her eyes. Yet there it was, in ink as violet as those eyes, on the notepaper that had become so familiar to her during the thrilling week just past. She read it a second time, and yet a third. Her amazement gave way to anger. Her cheeks flamed. Still, he had asked her not to judge until all his evidence was in. This was a reasonable request, surely, and she could not in fairness refuse to grant it. End of chapter 7.
Chapter 8 of the Agony Column. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Peek. The Agony Column by Earl Durr Biggers. Chapter 8. So began an anxious day, not only for the girl from Texas, but for all of London as well. Her father was bursting with new diplomatic secrets recently extracted from his bootblack adviser. Later, in Washington, he was destined to be a marked man because of his grasp of the situation abroad. No one suspected the bootblack, the power behind the throne, but the gentleman from Texas was destined to think of that able diplomat many times, and to wish that he still had him at his feet to advise him. "War by midnight, sure," he proclaimed on the morning of this fateful Tuesday. "I tell you, Marion, we're lucky to have our tickets on the Saronia. $5,000 wouldn't buy them for me today. I'll be a happy man when we go aboard that liner day after tomorrow." Day after tomorrow? The girl wondered. At any rate, she would have that last letter then, the letter that was to contain whatever defense her young friend could offer to explain his dastardly act. She waited eagerly for that final epistle. The day dragged on, bringing at its close England's entrance into the war, and the Carlton bootblack was a prophet not without honor in a certain Texas heart. And on the following morning there arrived a letter which was torn open by eager, trembling fingers. The letter spoke. "Dear Lady Judge, this is by far the hardest to write of all the letters you have had from me. For 24 hours I have been planning it. Last night I walked on the embankment while the hansoms jogged by, and the lights of the tram cars danced on the Westminster Bridge just as the fireflies used to in the garden back of our house in Kansas. While I walked, I planned. Today, shut up in my rooms, I was also planning, and yet now, when I sit down to write, I am still confused, still at a loss where to begin and what to say once I have begun. At the close of my last letter, I confess to you that it was I who murdered Captain Fraser Freer. That is the truth. Soften the blow as I may, it all comes down to that, the bitter truth. Not a week ago, last Thursday night at 7, I climbed our dark stairs and plunged a knife into the heart of that defenseless gentleman. If only I could point out to you that he had offended me in some way, if I could prove to you that his death was necessary to me, as it really was to Inspector Bray, then there might be some hope of your ultimate pardon. But, alas, he had been most kind to me, kinder than I have allowed you to guess from my letters. There was no actual need to do away with him. Where shall I look for a defense? At the moment, the only defense I can think of is simply this. The captain knows I killed him. Even as I write this, I hear his footsteps above me, as I heard them when I sat here composing my first letter to you. He is dressing for dinner. We are to dine together at Romano's. And there, my lady, you have finally the answer to the mystery that has, I hope, puzzled you. I killed my friend the captain in my second letter to you, and all the odd developments that followed lived only in my imagination as I sat here beside the green-shaded lamp in my study, plotting how I should write 7 letters to you that would, as the novel advertisements say, grip your attention to the very end. Oh, I am guilty, there is no denying that. And though I do not wish to ape old Adam and imply that I was tempted by a lovely woman, a strict regard for the truth forces me to add that there is also guilt upon your head. How so? Go back to that message you inserted in the Daily Mail, the grapefruit lady's great fondness for mystery and romance. You did not know it, of course, but in those words you passed me a challenge I could not resist, for making plots is the business of life, more the breath of life to me. I have made many, and perhaps you have followed some of them on Broadway. Perhaps you have seen a play of mine announced for early production in London. There was mention of it in the program at the Palace. That was the business which kept me in England. The project has been abandoned now, and I am free to go back home. Thus, you see that when you granted me the privilege of those 7 letters, you played into my hands. So, said I, she longs for mystery and romance. Then, by the Lord Harry, she shall have them. And it was the tramp of Captain Fraser Freer's boots above my head that showed me the way. A fine, stalwart, cordial fellow, the captain,
who has been very kind to me since I presented my letter of introduction from his cousin Archibald Enright. Poor Archie, a meek, correct little soul who would be horrified beyond expression if he knew that of him I had made a spy and a frequenter of Limehouse. The dim beginnings of the plot were in my mind when I wrote that first letter, suggesting that all was not regular in the matter of Archie's note of introduction. Before I wrote my second, I knew that nothing but the death of Fraser Freer would do me. I recalled that Indian knife I had seen upon his desk, and from that moment he was doomed. At that time I had no idea how I should solve the mystery, but I had read and wondered at those four strange messages in the mail, and I resolved that they must figure in the scheme of things. The fourth letter presented difficulties until I returned from dinner that night and saw a taxi waiting before our quiet house. Hence the visit of the woman with the lilac perfume. I am afraid the Wilhelmstrasse will have little use for a lady spy who advertised herself in so foolish a manner. Time for writing the fifth letter arrived. I felt that I should now be placed under arrest. I had a faint little hope that you would be sorry about that. Oh, I am a brute, I know. Early in the game I had told the captain of the cruel way in which I had disposed of him. He was much amused, but he insisted absolutely that he must be vindicated before the close of the series, and I was with him there. He had been so bully about it all. A chance remark of his gave me my solution. He said he had it on good authority that the chief of the Tsar's Bureau for Capturing Spies in Russia was himself a spy, and so, why not a spy in Scotland Yard? I assure you, I am most contrite as I set all this down here. You must remember that when I began my story there was no idea of war. Now all Europe is aflame, and in the face of the great conflict, the awful suffering to come, I and my little plot begin to look, well, I fancy you know just how we look. Forgive me. I am afraid I can never find the words to tell you how important it seemed to interest you in my letters, to make you feel that I am an entertaining person worthy of your notice. That morning when you entered the Carlton breakfast room was really the biggest in my life. I felt as though you had brought with you through that doorway, but I have no right to say it. I have the right to say nothing save that now it is all left to you. If I have offended, then I shall never hear from you again. The captain will be here in a moment. It is near the hour set, and he is never late. He is not to return to India, but expects to be drafted for the expeditionary force that will be sent to the continent. I hope the German army will be kinder to him than I was. My name is Geoffrey West. I live at 19 Adelphi Terrace, in rooms that look down on the most wonderful garden in London. That, at least, is real. It is very quiet there tonight, with the city and its continuous hum of war and terror seemingly a million miles away. Shall we meet at last? The answer rests entirely with you, but believe me, I shall be anxious waiting to know, and if you decide to give me a chance to explain, to denounce myself to you in person, then a happy man will say goodbye to this garden and these dim, dusty rooms and follow you to the ends of the earth, aye, to Texas itself. Captain Fraser Freer is coming down the stairs. Is this goodbye forever, my lady? With all my soul, I hope not. Your contrite strawberry man. End of chapter 8.
Chapter 9 of the Agony Column. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Peak. The Agony Column by Earl Durr Biggers. Chapter 9. Words are futile things with which to attempt a description of the feelings of the girl at the Carlton as she read this, the last letter of seven written to her through the medium of her maid, Sadie Haight. Turning the pages of the dictionary casually, one might enlist a few, for example, amazement, anger, unbelief, wonder. Perhaps, to go back to the letter A, even amusement. We may leave her with the solution to the puzzle in her hand, the Saronia a little more than a day away, and a weirdly mixed company of emotions struggling in her soul. And leaving her thus, let us go back to Adelphi Terrace, and a young man exceedingly worried. Once he knew that his letter was delivered, Mr. Geoffrey West took his place most humbly on the anxious seat.
There he writhed through the long hours of Wednesday morning. Not to prolong this painful picture, let us hasten to add that at 3 o'clock that same afternoon came a telegram that was to end suspense. He tore it open and read, "Strawberry Man, I shall never, never forgive you. But we are sailing tomorrow on the Saronia. Were you thinking of going home soon? Marion A. Larned." Thus it happened that a few minutes later, to the crowd of troubled Americans in a certain steamship booking office, there was added a wild-eyed young man who further upset all who saw him. To weary clerks he proclaimed in fiery tones that he must sail on the Saronia. There seemed to be no way of appeasing him. The offer of a private liner would not have interested him. He raved and tore his hair. He ranted, all to no avail. There was, in plain American, nothing doing. Damp but determined, he sought among the crowd for one who had bookings on the Saronia. He could find at first no one so lucky, but finally he ran across Tommy Gray. Gray, an old friend, admitted when pressed that he had a passage on that most desirable boat, but the offer of all the king's horses and all the king's gold left him unmoved. Much, he said, as he would have liked to oblige, he and his wife were determined they would sail. It was then that Geoffrey West made a compact with his friend. He secured from him the necessary steamer labels, and it was arranged that his baggage was to go aboard the Saronia as the property of Gray. "But," protested Gray, "even supposing that you do put this through, suppose you do manage to sail without a ticket, where will you sleep? In chains somewhere below, I fancy." "No matter," bubbled West. "I'll sleep in the dining salon, in a lifeboat, on the lee scuppers, whatever they are. I'll sleep in the air without any visible support. I'll sleep anywhere, nowhere, but I'll sail. And as for irons, they don't make 'em strong enough to hold me." At 5 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, the Saronia slipped smoothly away from a Liverpool dock. 2,500 Americans, about twice the number the boat could comfortably carry, stood on her decks and cheered. Some of those in that crowd who had millions of money were booked for the steerage. All of them were destined to experience during that crossing hunger, annoyance, discomfort. They were to be stepped on, sat on, crowded, and jostled. They suspected as much when the boat left the dock, yet they cheered. Gayest among them was Geoffrey West, triumphant amid the confusion. He was safely aboard. The boat was on its way. Little did it trouble him that he went as a stowaway, since he had no ticket. Nothing but an overwhelming determination to be on the good ship Saronia. That night, as the Saronia stole along with all deck lights out and every portal curtained, West saw on the dim deck the slight figure of a girl who meant much to him. She was standing staring out over the black waters, and with wildly beating heart he approached her, not knowing what to say, but feeling that a start must be made somehow. "Please pardon me for addressing," he began, "but I want to tell you—" She turned, startled, and then smiled an odd little smile which you could not see in the dark. "I beg your pardon," she said. "I haven't met you that I recall." "I know," he answered. "That's going to be arranged tomorrow. Mrs. Tommy Gray says you crossed with them."
"Mere steamer acquaintances," the girl replied coldly.
"Of course. But Mrs. Gray is a darling. She'll fix that all right. I just want to say, before tomorrow comes, wouldn't it be better to wait?"
"I can't. I'm on this ship without a ticket. I've got to go down in a minute and tell the purser that. Maybe he'll throw me overboard, and maybe he'll lock me up. I don't know what they do with people like me. Maybe they'll make a stoker of me, and then I shall have to stoke with no chance of seeing you again. So that's why I want to say now, I'm sorry I have such a keen imagination. It carried me away, really it did. I didn't mean to deceive you with those letters, but once I got started, you know, don't you, that I love you with all my heart. From the moment you came into the Carlton that morning, I—"
"Really, Mr.
West, Geoffrey West, I adore you. But what can I do to prove it?"
"I'm going to prove it, before this ship docks in the North River. Perhaps I'd better talk to your father, and tell him about the agony column and those 7 letters."
"You'd better not. He's in a terrible bad humor. The dinner was awful, and the steward said we'd be looking back to it and calling it a banquet before the voyage ends. Then, too, poor Dad says he simply cannot sleep in the stateroom they've given him. All the better. I'll see him at once. If he stands for me now, he'll stand for me any time. And before I go down and beard a harsh-looking purser in his den, won't you believe me when I say I'm deeply in love with mystery and romance, in love with your own remarkable powers of invention? Really, I can't take you seriously. Before this voyage is ended, you'll have to. I'll prove to you that I care. If the purser lets me go free... You have much to prove, the girl smiled. Tomorrow, when Mrs. Tommy Gray introduces us, I may accept you as a builder of plots. I happen to know you are good, but as... It's too silly. Better go and have it out with that purser. Reluctantly, he went. In 5 minutes, he was back. The girl was still standing by the rail. It's all right, West said. I thought I was doing something original, but there are 11 other people in the same fix. One of them is a billionaire from Wall Street. The purser collected some money from us and told us to sleep on the deck, if we could find room. I'm sorry, said the girl. I rather fancied you in the role of stoker. She glanced about her at the dim deck. Isn't this exciting? I'm sure this voyage is going to be filled with mystery and romance. I know it will be full of romance, West answered, and the mystery will be, can I convince you? Hush, broke in the girl. Here comes Father. I shall be very happy to meet you tomorrow. Poor Dad, he's looking for a place to sleep. 5 days later, poor Dad, having slept each night on deck in his clothes while the ship plowed through a cold drizzle, and having starved in a sadly depleted dining saloon, was a sight to move the heart of a political opponent. Immediately after a dinner that had scarcely satisfied a healthy Texas appetite, he lounged gloomily in a deck chair which was now his stateroom. Jauntily, Jeffrey West came and sat at his side. "Mr. Larned," he said, "I've got something for you." And with a kindly smile, he took from his pocket and handed over a large, warm, baked potato. The Texan eagerly accepted the gift. "Where'd you get it?" he demanded, breaking open his treasure. "That's a secret," West answered, "but I can get as many as I want. Mr. Larned, I can say this. You will not go hungry any longer. And there's something else I ought to speak of. I am sort of aiming to marry your daughter." Deep in his potato, the congressman spoke. "What does she say about it?" "Oh, she says there isn't a chance, but..." "Then look out, my boy. She's made up her mind to have you." "I'm glad to hear you say that. I really ought to tell you who I am. Also, I want you to know that, before your daughter and I met, I wrote her 7 letters." "One minute," broke in the Texan. "Before you go into all that, won't you be a good fellow and tell me where you got this potato?" West nodded. "Sure," he said, and leaning over, he whispered. For the first time in days, a smile appeared on the face of the older man. "My boy," he said, "I feel I'm going to like you. Never mind the rest. I heard all about you from your friend Gray, and as for those letters, they were the only thing that made the first part of this trip bearable. Marion gave them to me to read the night we came on board." Suddenly, from out of the clouds, a long-lost moon appeared and bathed that overcrowded ocean liner in a flood of silver. West left the old man to his potato and went to find the daughter. She was standing in the moonlight by the rail of the forward deck, her eyes staring dreamily ahead toward the great country that had set her forth lightheartedly for to adventure and to sea. She turned as West came up. "I have just been talking with your father," he said. "He tells me he thinks you mean to take me after all." She laughed. "Tomorrow night," she answered, "will be our last on board. I shall give you my final decision then." "But that is 24 hours away. Must I wait so long as that?" "A little suspense won't hurt you. I can't forget those long days when I waited for your letters." "I know, but can't you give me just a little hint? Here, tonight?" "I am without mercy. Absolutely without mercy." And then, as West's fingers closed over her hand, she added softly, "Not even the suspicion of a hint, my dear, except to tell you that my answer will be yes." End of chapter 9. Recording by Peak. End of the Agony Column by Earl Durr Biggers.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.